You've lost the urge to experiment.
Her brain kept alive by experimental science, by a man whose abnormal passions inspired him to try the impossible.
And welcome to the latest episode of 13 O'Clock. Hope everyone is doing well today.
Yeah, what do you have to announce? So you have a show you're going to be on, don't you?
Yes. Well, actually, the first thing I would like to do, like to give a shout out to End of Days Radio, Michael Deacon. And I was live on End of Days on this past Saturday night, which was the 15th.
They should post that up.
And they usually post up the archive shows.
End of Days Radio.
Yeah.
I wasn't on it that night. I've been on it before.
Yeah.
But it's just Jenny on her own to promote her new book.
Yeah, it's a good show.
So, yeah. And then you got another one this week coming up, don't you?
Yeah, I'm also, tomorrow I'll be taping an interview with Jim Harold.
Yeah, Jim Harold.
For, I believe it's going to be his Ghost Insight show. He has several.
He's got a bunch of shows.
He's got several radio shows. So, yeah, I'm going to be on that promoting my new book, which, as I said last week, is called The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena.
Yeah.
And it's now out in print, ebook, and audiobook.
Right.
Available on Amazon. So, you know, if you're into poltergeist stuff and want to read about pretty much every poltergeist case I could find from the past, since the first century.
Right.
If you're into that kind of thing, then pick up a copy. And if you like it, then give me a review, because that really does help.
Yeah. So what's on the show today?
Oh, well, wait a minute. First, Project Entertainment Network. I always have to say about that.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know. Shout out to them, like we usually do. And so the topic today is mad science.
Okay.
Now,
mad science, not weird science.
Well, here's the thing. I didn't want to call it weird science.
Right.
And that's the thing. Like,
that's the song you have to play at the end of the
Yeah,
show.
And I know that that would have been the most obvious one, but that wasn't the one. I went with the second most obvious one.
Don't spoil it.
I went with the second most obvious song, not weird science. Now, I've been wanting to do like kind of a mad science kind of show for a while. I wanted to stick with cases that maybe weren't as well known as some of the kind of bigger ones. I also didn't want to go full on like war atrocities, like, you know.
Yeah, the human experimentation.
Like Nazi human experiment, like Mengele and all that kind of stuff.
Japanese.
Yeah, I thought that
would be. The North Koreans are actually doing that too.
Yeah, like all the vivisection and like poisoning twins and all that kind of shit.
Right.
It's like, you know, I was like, that might be too much of a bummer. Not like we haven't done bummer shows in the past, but, you know. I thought it would be, but not that these cases are like super fun or anything like that, but I just, these were the ones that I thought were
weird.
Kind of interesting and sort of weird.
Okay.
And the thing about these cases too is that other than the Freud one, which I don't think was very useful at all, these other ones, as kind of strange and unethical as they were, they actually maybe did provide some useful information going forward. So it's just kind of, you know, the way that the information was obtained was perhaps not so pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first one we're going to talk about is Dr. Harry Harlow. And I don't know if a lot of people, his name is not super common, but probably most people have heard of his monkey studies because they're actually quite famous. Now, Harry Harlow was a psychologist. And initially, he started out studying cognition and memory and stuff like that. And he used, rhesus macaques, as, you know, a lot of people, well, they still do, as far as I know. And since he was experimenting using the baby rhesus macaques, so he, in 1932, he established a breeding colony of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he kind of would take them out, like the ones he was going to use in the experiments, he would take them away from their mothers when they were babies, and he would raise them in nursery settings. Like, they, you know, he would train, like, his students and undergraduates and stuff that, you know, how to care for them and stuff like that. But he started to notice that the monkeys that were taken away from their mothers were kind of messed up. Like, they were kind of socially... they were very clingy. Like, he noticed that they had little cloth diapers and they would, like, hang on to them like they were, like, security blankets.
Yeah.
He also noticed that they displayed a lot of fear and aggression, and that they didn't socialize well with the other monkeys. Not, you know, not the same way that the monkeys that were raised by their mothers did. So then he kind of got interested in the infant maternal bond. Now, it should be noted that prior to this time, this was in the 1930s that he was doing most of his studies. Prior to this time, it was largely accepted in this in the field of psychology that the only reason that children bonded with their mothers was because that was where they got food from. So they didn't think, you know, largely they didn't think that there was any other type of bonding happening between a mother and the kid. They thought it was just because that's where milk comes from. And so this is why I think, you know, modern people look back at sort of the way they treated children, you know, in the end of the, you know, 19th century, early 20th century, like the orphanages and stuff like that, where they didn't think it was detrimental to children to not be, to not have any affection displayed toward them or be picked
they
up.
They neglected them.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, they didn't think that was harmful.
Right.
And they thought that if you did do it, then it was harmful because it was spoiling them.
Right.
So they kind of encouraged parents to like, oh, don't pick your kids up. Don't show them any affection. Don't do anything like that. So that was kind of not the consensus, obviously, but because there were some psychologists that disagreed with that in the 1930s. But, you know, that was kind of the majority kind of had that view.
Probably why there were so many psychos during that time.
And that's what I was going to think. That's what I was thinking, too. Maybe that's why people were so messed up like back then. Because, spoiler alert, that is actually very, very harmful to children to treat them that way. And actually, it was largely because of this guy's, of Dr. Harlow's work, that this was figured out. Now, the first thing he did was kind of a maternal experiment, because he wanted to show that there were other things going on with the bonding than just food. So what he would do was he would take these baby monkeys, he built a wire mother, and he built a cloth mother. And now he said that the baby monkeys, they, you know, they recognized these, you know, fake surrogate mothers, you know, and they would prefer the one that was assigned to them before over all other ones. Now he wanted to see, he's like, okay, he took the wire mother and put a bottle on it so they could be nursed off of. And then, you know, he would do it both ways. He would have the wire mother with the thing, and then the cloth mother didn't have milk. Or he would take where the cloth mother had milk and then the wire mother didn't have milk. Now, he said even when the wire mother had the bottle attached, the monkeys would go over and drink from that, but then they would go right back to the cloth mother and hug it.
So I've seen photographs of that.
Yeah, there are photographs.
Had a little happy face kind of thing on the top of the.
It's a, it was
like
kind
a
of
little monkey face.
Yeah, it was like a pretty famous experiment.
Yeah.
So from that, he said, okay, well, obviously they're getting something else, you know, from these surrogates other than just milk, because, you know, they didn't love the wire mothers at all. They just went over there to get milk, and then they went back and cuddled on the cloth one. And he said it was interesting too, because they used the cloth mother almost like a, as a base of exploration. You know, like they would go back to the cloth mother if something scary was like introduced into the cage or something like that. So they used it for reassurance and protection and stuff like that. Now, this is not to say that these baby monkeys that were raised by the surrogate mothers were still kind of messed up. They weren't, you know, because they didn't really get to interact with any other baby monkeys. And they didn't get to interact with a real mother. They turned out better than later ones, but you know, they were still had some problems, although most of them were able to be rehabilitated. Like when they got a little bit older, like he would reintroduce them back into, you know, and let them hang out with like other little monkeys their age. And then they would usually be all right. He's like, they were usually still kind of introverted and sometimes aggressive or something like that, but not too bad. But then he kind of got... He kind of got interested in what if these baby monkeys were completely deprived of any interaction whatsoever, not even a fake mother.
That's a dick move.
And, you know, so, and like I said, valuable information, but it almost, it's like, why did you have to go to that next level, man? It's like these little monkeys. Those are baby monkeys.
Yeah, I know.
How could you do that?
I don't know.
So he built this box. And here's another thing. Harlow, evidently, he was kind of an anti-establishment kind of like, I don't like the psychological establishment kind of guy. And he didn't like kind of the euphemisms. Well, I guess because he had used this, you know, love deprivation kind of experimentation, and he called it love. He's like in the psychology field at the time, they called it attachment. Right. And he thought that was kind of bullshit. And he's like, well, they should call things what they are. And, you know, he had this one thing that he built that was like a forced mating kind of contraption. And he called it the rape wreck.
What?
You know?
Damn.
So he kind of called things what they were. So what he did was he built this. It was a sensory deprivation kind of box. Mm-hmm. And he called it the pit of despair.
Right.
Like he named it that. It wasn't somebody else named it that. He named it that. And this was, you know, basically.
Wait, hold on.
Whoa.
I got to go back to this rape machine. What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
You know, it's weird because I don't know how many.
He was raping monkeys on it?
He wasn't raping monkeys.
Oh, okay.
He was forcing them to mate with each other.
How the hell did they do that?
I don't know. I don't really have any idea.
And what was the effects of that?
I don't know.
No, it wasn't mentioned in the.
Not really. I know. It's like you can't really say rape rack and then not really expound on it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, man.
But yeah.
This dude's a dick.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, I appreciate that he actually, you know, came to the psychological, establishment. It was like, no, you have to love your kids and like pick them up and like show them affection or stuff like that. Otherwise, they turn out fucked up.
Well, what's the pit of despair, though?
The pit of despair, he built, and this was in the 50s. So he had been doing quite a lot of experimentation through the 30s and 40s. But what he would do, he had partial isolation where he would have, you know, a cage where the baby monkeys could see other baby monkeys, but couldn't touch them or couldn't do anything like that. And then he had some that were in the pit of despair that were these total isolation chambers.
Was it dark in there or light in there?
You know,
did it say?
I don't think it really said. They looked like, I mean, there's a couple photos of them, like on the internet. I'll put it in the YouTube video. It looked like it would have been dark in there.
Okay.
But they couldn't hear any other monkeys. They couldn't see them. They couldn't touch them. They couldn't smell them. They couldn't anything like that. And sometimes he had different time periods that he would leave them in there.
Mm-hmm.
Like so he would leave them alone for 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years.
Damn.
And he would leave them. Like, obviously, he fed them and stuff like that. But, the people that fed them like weren't allowed to interact with them or anything like that.
Yeah.
And he left them in their total social deprivation.
Yeah, damn. That's cruelty.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
The sad thing is that, I mean, none of the monkeys died while they were in isolation. But, you know, obviously, depending on how long they stayed in. Now, one that had been in there for 3 months, when they let him out, he wouldn't eat and he starved to death. Like, you know, cause he was so messed up. And that was only after 3 months. He left some in there for like a year.
Damn.
And he said, when those monkeys came out, they acted like they had severe autism. He's like, they would pretty much curl up in a corner. They stared at nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They would hug themselves and just rock back and forth. Things like that. They were just totally...
Couldn't fix them.
Damn. Now, some of them were able to be rehabilitated a little bit.
Right.
Like, if they were reintroduced back into their peer group and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were never really right again.
Right.
But some of them kind of got over the weird... Like, it took a while.
Hmm.
But it's just... It's sad because... And here's the thing. Like I said, is this important research? Probably... But
I would think it'd be pretty obvious that would screw you up. Why do you need to experiment with
it? But like I said, it seemed weird that like at the time that he started, like in the early 1930s, it was almost kind of like a given that no, you shouldn't like pamper your kids or you shouldn't like hug your kids or anything like that because it spoils them. That's so hilarious. Obviously it did need to be experimented on because people didn't know shit.
Yeah.
So, weird. And the sad thing about it, it's like, like I said, the guy's, you know, research was probably valuable and it probably helped a lot in, you know, mother-infant attachment and things like that. But it must be said, the guy not an animal lover.
No.
He did not like, and he said that straight out. He's like, I don't like animals.
Huh.
He said, I don't like cats. I don't like dogs. I don't, he's like, how can you love a monkey? I'm like, but here's the thing.
He's a dick.
The whole point of doing experiments on monkeys
right.
is because they're so similar to humans.
Yeah, he doesn't like people.
So I guess he must be a misanthrope as well, because monkeys are very similar to people. I mean, that's the whole point of using them in experiments, because their reactions are so similar. Right.
I'm not like an animal rights activist where I go out, you know, it's like, oh, you can't wear fur or anything. You know, I've actually hunted, you know, but every animal I've killed, I ate it. You know what I mean? You don't waste animals. And here's the thing. High animals like monkeys, monkeys aren't really prey animals. You know, not my point of view, you know, deer and birds, you know. You eat those.
Yeah.
You know, but...
Other animals eat those.
Eat those. They have a high reproductive
rate.
But
there's I mean, I don't see any point in... And I'm not...
Doing what he's doing. I don't think.
And now, I mean, it should be said, too, that it was probably largely his work that led to kind of the animal liberation movement and more attention being drawn to how animals were treated.
Sure, animals can suffer.
In captivity. Sure, they can.
It's obvious that they can.
And like I said, I don't necessarily have a problem with some types of animal experimentation, depending on what it is. But
if it's saving human lives and, you know.
Right. But there's a fine line. And there's a fine line between, you know, are you making these animals suffer needlessly?
Yeah. And in this case, I would say yes.
Yes. Why would you take a poor little baby monkey? And Rhesus macaques are adorable. Yeah. Especially the babies are adorable. They look like little fuzzy human babies.
Yeah. And totally ruin this little animal's life.
Forever.
Yeah. That's a.
I mean, they messed them up forever, pretty much. They were never right again, really.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, it's awful. Yeah. But, you know, like I said, it's a mad science show. So, Okay, so, all right. The next thing I want to talk about, since that was a little bit of a bummer. Well, actually, this one's kind of a bummer, too. But, okay. Next thing I want to talk about is the Hoffling Hospital experiment. Now, after World War II, and particularly after the Nuremberg trials, there was a lot of interest in the psychological field about how the Germans had gone along with Nazi atrocities. So they were interested in studies of how people reacted to authority, how easy it was to get people to compromise their principles and things of that nature. Now, probably the most famous experiment in that line was the Milgram experiment, where, you know, most people know Stanley Milgram and he did it. And
the simulated prison.
That was the Stanford experiment.
That's right,
okay. The Milgram experiment was... when they got people that he said it's ostensibly about, the study was about punishment on learning.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I remember.
Yeah. He would shock people, quote unquote, the learners if they got something wrong.
Yeah.
And it was alarming how many of the people, I mean, obviously the people weren't really being shocked. They just told the subjects that they were shocking them. It was alarming how many of the people would shock these people what they thought was to their death.
Yeah, to a lethal death.
Just because someone in a lab coat told them to.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there was also kind of, this wasn't like a scientifically, like a lab experiment, but one kind of social experiment that a teacher did was the third wave, where he did it with his high school class because he wanted to see how easily his students could be sucked into fascism, because he was doing a chapter on Nazi Germany, and he wanted to demonstrate to them how easy it would have been to get them to go along with all this kind of stuff. And that pretty much only took about 5 days before they were all in, man. So, you know, a little alarming.
Just tell them it's for a good cause. Fascism is always for a good cause. That's what they tell them.
Well, but yeah, and it's like, so it is like kind of alarming how easy it is to get people to do things, you know, even psychologically normal people to get things to do that they wouldn't normally do, probably. So the Hoffling Hospital experiment was kind of similar. It was kind of a study of authority and how people would kind of just do whatever if somebody in authority told them to. And this happened actually in the 60s, 1966. Now, he wanted to do like a field experiment. Now, the first thing he did, it was between doctors and nurses. So he took surveys of a bunch of nurses and a bunch of nursing students. And he said, now, if a doctor that you didn't know asked you to do XYZ that you knew wasn't right, would you do it? Now, overwhelmingly, like 99% of them, said, of course not. Of course they're not going to listen to some doctor that tells them to do something that they know isn't right. Okay, well then, he's like, all right. So he did the actual experiment. What he did was he had an accomplice call a hospital and say he was a doctor named Dr. Smith. And he told a whole bunch of nurses, give the patients 20 milligrams of this fictitious drug. The drug was called Astroten.
Okay.
Now, prior to this, they had actually had a bottle made that said Astroten and, you know, it had a little label on it and everything. Now, the label said maximum dose, 10 milligrams.
Right.
Now, nurses in pretty much every hospital, I'm sure in the 60s and I'm sure nowadays, are told many things. And one of them is like, don't take, you know, don't take instructions from a doctor you don't know who it is.
Right.
You know, and don't administer things without the proper paperwork and all this other kind of stuff. So this doctor calls these, all these nurses, says, I'm Dr. Smith. I don't have the paperwork to have this drug administered, but I'll do it when I get there. Administer 20 milligrams of this fictitious drug called Astroten to these particular patients. All but one of them did it. All but one.
Wow.
And, you know, the one that did it was just like, nah, that's not right. I don't have the paperwork and I don't, and this says 10 milligrams and he said 20. I don't know who this guy is and stuff like that.
Right.
And, you know, so, so he or she, they didn't specify, but he or she would not do it. But the other ones all did.
Wow. Because it was an authority figure telling them
to do it. Because it was an authority figure telling them to do it.
Right.
And even the ones that had done it had actually been some of the people in the survey beforehand that had said they would never do such a thing.
Right. Yeah.
And like I said, this, the outcome was pretty much the same as the, now I think in the Milgram experiment, those weren't doctors, they were scientists, you know, but, you know, same diff. But they had people say, you know, oh, it'll be fine. Just keep shocking the people and whatever. Even when the dude in the other one was like screaming and stuff like that.
I saw a movie about that, an old movie from the 70s.
Yeah.
And they're, you hear the guy in the other room go, no, please, no more, no more. And the other, and the guy in the white coat's going, no, go ahead. You can shock him. It's part of the experiment. He's like, you sure?
Yeah.
Do it. He goes, that might kill him. He goes, it's not on you.
Yeah.
Basically.
And people are like, okay.
Yeah.
Now, but some people, I think more people in the Milgram experiment did say no.
Right.
Like they left.
Right.
Because that's the thing. That's the thing I don't understand. Like, I don't want to say that would never happen. But I mean, I'm a very, like I said, and I think I mentioned this on our show about cults where I'm just kind of like, when somebody tells me to do something, I'm just like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. it doesn't work that way in cults and even in political type organizations. People will do what they're told if they believe what they're doing is morally the correct thing.
Yeah.
You just have to set up a long history with a person of a certain belief structure. Really, you have to set that up first to prime them.
Yeah.
To get them to do whatever.
Well, in a lot of ways, you know, if you do it kind of slowly, and like I said, I think this kind of happened in Nazi Germany as well. It kind of just ramped up in notches. It just kind of ratcheted up.
Right.
It wasn't like they just came out and were like, let's kill all the Jews.
Right.
You know, it was kind of like a slow progression up to that.
Well, they just start off with anger towards them.
Yeah.
And then eventually one day we'll get them. Yeah. We're going to make them pay. And eventually it's, we're making them pay right now. That's eventually, but don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just politics though. Religions do the same thing.
Well, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like I said, it's like the fabled frog in boiling water. You know, it's just like just little steps at a time. And suddenly you're committing war atrocities and you have no idea how you got there.
Yeah. And it's always like, Nietzsche said, you know, he who chases dragons too long becomes a dragon himself.
Yeah, or like gazing into the abyss. Yeah,
the fascism of the future is anti-fascism. If you can take anything to extremes.
Well, yeah, that for sure. Right. Anything can be taken to extremes.
Right. You kind of see that now, some of the stuff, the political extremism going on in American politics and in American society. You know, extremists are being created.
Yeah, I mean, you know, generally that does happen. I think people kind of become more polarized.
But although I think the center is getting bigger.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. As the center gets larger, I think the extremes get more. They get smaller, but they get more radicalized. Yeah. That's kind of happened throughout history, I think.
Yeah.
But we're coming up to the halfway point, so I'm going to take a break right now. And when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit about Freud, and we're also going to talk a little bit about a kind of a pretty sad case of sex reassignment gone wrong.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
And, yeah, this was a really terrible case. And I read the book about it and stuff, too.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that when we get back, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Once upon a time, a madman, poet, and thief known as John Urbansick, that's me, challenged himself, myself, to write a story a day, every day, for a year, by hand. Some of them worked. Some of them failed. Some of them were spectacular. Then I did it again. Join me every week for Ink Stains as I do it a third time. And I will read you some of these stories. I'll talk about the process, about creativity in general, writing in specific, and maybe I can help ignite your artistic adventures.
Subculture Corsets and Clothing is our favorite store for unusual clothing, shoes, and accessories. They offer a wide selection of men's and women's clothing at great prices. Subculture also offers a cool selection of shoes and accessories. Steampunk, gothic apparel, retro, corsets, and so much more at Subculture Corsets and Clothing. Check out Subculture online at subculturecorsets.com. That's subculturecorsets.com. Make sure you use the discount code 13O'Clock for a 10% discount. Subculturecorsets.com or visit their store in Jacksonville, Florida, just off I-95.
Three guys with beards.
The usual gang of idiots. That's me, Christopher Golden.
New York Times best-selling authors.
My name is Jim Moore.
Interviews with pop culture stars and creators.
So I'm Jonathan Mayberry.
And they don't talk about politics.
Course of Human Events.
Jesus, let's not talk about the Course of Human Events today.
I said they don't talk about politics.
I suspect we may bend our rule about no politics on the beards and talk about politics on the beards.
Didn't you say they don't talk about politics?
If somebody else says something, we should...
Thank you.
Can anyone hear me? Am I all alone here?
Three guys with beards.
Tuesdays, exclusively on Project Entertainment Network.
The Unseen Hand. A new exploration of poltergeist phenomena by Jenny Ashford. Author of The Rochdale Poltergeist, House of Fire and Whispers, and The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. The Unseen Hand is a comprehensive collection of over 100 reported poltergeist cases from the first century to the present day. All the best-known cases are presented, from the Bell Witch to Jeff the Talking Mongoose, from Rosenheim to Tina Resch, from Enfield to The Entity. A large selection of fascinating and lesser-known accounts from all over the world are also included, and all contain testimony from the most eerie and extraordinary events. The Unseen Hand is the ultimate compendium for readers interested in poltergeist disturbances throughout history and the theories behind what causes them. On sale now from Amazon in print, ebook, and audiobook formats. Go to Unseen Handbook on Facebook and visit www.jennyashford.com for more information.
All right, and we're back talking about mad science. Now, this one's not quite as much of a bummer because this one's just kind of, well, it was a bummer.
We got the bummer one out of the way.
Yeah, it was a bummer for one person.
Damn,
but
monkeys. I love those monkeys. I like monkeys just as much as I like squirrels.
Yeah. Oh my God, you have no squirrels. Idea how much he loves squirrels.
I love squirrels. We go on our walk, the squirrels come down, I talk to the squirrels.
Yeah.
I try to encourage the squirrels to come at me, bro. You know, it doesn't really work, but they do watch me. They go, man, it's crazy.
He's like the squirrel whisperer.
Yeah, I'm going to start taking crackers with me.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah,
oh my God. Then every day we'll go for a walk and then you'll just get mobbed. They'll be jumping on your head and stuff. Yeah. And I'm going to videotape every second of that shit.
Yeah, we'll put that in the podcast.
Yeah, that would be fun. That'd be funny as hell.
All right.
So this one was a kind of a bummer for one person, but in a way it was kind of like goofy for everyone else involved. Now, Sigmund Freud, obviously very famous person, a lot of his beliefs kind of pseudoscientific. He had some legit ideas in there.
Overall, man, you know.
But overall.
Freud was a quack.
Kind of a quack.
Freud was a quack.
I'm going to say.
He was an important quack, though.
Yeah.
But he was a quack.
Like I said, some of the shit he came up with, I don't have any beef with. Some of it was pretty legit. Okay, so what ended up happening? Now, Freud had a patient named Emma Eckstein, and he actually saw her for 3 years, I think. She was one of his longest-termed early patients. Now, she was actually, I'm not sure if she was a psychoanalyst while she was being treated or if she became one later, but she, you know, she was very, you know, on that bandwagon, and she actually became a psychoanalyst herself later on and was actually quite well respected and had some, you know, some stuff published that, you know, is still kind of read today. But she initially went to Freud complaining about stomach problems, like digestive problems, and menstruation-related depression. Now, because this was Freud, and Freud is kind of like, everything is a sexual problem, whether it's a sexual problem or not, he basically said, well, you're a woman, so obviously you have hysteria. Because women be crazy. Bitches hysterical, be crazy.
Hysterical bitches.
Yeah, we're so crazy. Yeah. And also, that her hysteria was caused by her masturbating too much.
Yeah.
Because evidently, I mean, at the time,
I think Freud was fantasizing too much, if you ask me.
I think so too, because I kind of feel like that said a lot more about Freud than it did about his patients. For real, like some of the shit he came up with.
Stop diddling yourself.
I can't let it go. I can't let I was going to do it in a German
accent. It's your fault. It's your fault, bitch.
It is, right?
Oh, Victorian era.
Well, yeah, and it should be said that, I mean, Freud was not the only one. It's like masturbation back then was considered to be a sign of mental illness.
Yeah,
especially
so they were all crazy.
especially if you did it too much. Well, I don't know how much too much is, but whatever. I'm like, so everyone on Earth is crazy then? Awesome. Pretty much.
People from that area were, people from that era, they were nuts.
Yeah. Sleepy. Yeah.
Kind of sleepy. It's all right, I'll be all right.
How are you sleepy? You slept so late.
I don't know. Waiting for that Xbox to show up.
Oh, yeah.
Got one of the new Xboxes. Xbox One.
I know. Now, keep in mind, too, that I still have 4 or 5 episodes of the new Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, which is good, which is very good.
I gave to the Kickstarter, you guys. This is how excited I was about this, because I am, like, the world's biggest Mystery Science Theater fan. I love that shit. And I'm like an old school fan. I started watching it like in the early 90s, 92, 93.
So we
I think
go
I started
from
watching
female
it.
Masturbation to.
Well, I'll get back to that in a second. I'll go back to that in a second. Okay. But yeah, so I was scared. Like I gave them a bunch of money in the Kickstarter, but, you know, I got a shirt and I got all kind of neat stuff, but I was kind of scared. I'm like, oh, it's all new people. And, you know, is it going to be the same and stuff? It rocks. It's so funny. It's like, it's super hilarious. It's like, it's still, it's all new people, but it still has the same kind of charm and they didn't change a lot. You know, it's still kind of the same.
I wasn't a huge fan of the originals. I mean, I thought it was kind of funny.
Yeah.
But that kind of humor really wasn't my thing. But this new one, I think the humor is
Well, I think they went...
They have musical humor, a lot of joking.
Yeah.
Breakout
I think
singing.
That a lot of the references aren't quite as obscure
They're
as maybe
obscure,
on the old
yeah.
show.
So a lot of that shit was... You have to be like super, super dorky to get a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, which I am. I admit that. I know. He knows.
So I like Dave Chappelle. That's my level.
Well, I like him too, though.
I like Dave Chappelle.
I kind of like lowbrow and highbrow, but that's why I always liked Mystery Science Theater, because they kind of had something for everybody.
Right.
But so anyway, excessive masturbation, as we were talking about.
Yeah, we'll get back to that.
Okay, so this was this woman's problem, evidently.
Yeah.
Now, it so happened that at the time, Freud was buddy-buddy with a guy named Wilhelm Fleiss, who was actually an ear, nose, and throat specialist. Now, much like Freud thought everything was sex problems, Fleiss thought everything was nose problems and also sex problems. So he kind of combined those two things because noses and fucking go so nicely together. And so he developed this kind of theory that was called, I think it was called nasal reflex neurosis. Yeah, that's what it was called.
Yeah.
And where it was some kind of thing where... I'm not sure if he kind of thought that there was some kind of relationship between your nose and your genitalia. So I'm not sure if he went the whole way of like saying, well, if you pick your nose, it's just kind of like, you know.
People from the 1800s were pervs.
They were pervs, man.
Yeah. They're weird.
It's like they talk about people perverted nowadays. I'm like, no, we didn't have nothing on those people. I think because they were so repressed
they just
got kind of warped.
Yeah, they were warped. They had to have been warped.
Yeah.
Think about it.
In a way, I like it better now, now that the internet's there and it's like, you know, people have like weird fetishes, but you can find other people online that have weird fetishes and shit. As long as you're not hurting anybody, I don't give a crap.
I think weird fetishes drove them crazy back then.
Yeah, because...
Well, and the repression would cause more fetishes, weirder fetishes.
Yeah, because of the guilt and because you didn't know anyone else. You thought you were the only one and you thought you were a weirdo and stuff like that.
You end up with a bunch of Albert Fish type dudes.
That's what I mean. It's like, I kind of think that contributed to maybe this kind of perverted serial killer type thing. Because I don't know if you see that as much as you used to. Like, or at least...
It was bad in the 70s and 80s, I remember.
Yeah.
But I think it's gotten better. I think internet has taken a lot of pressure off those guys.
Yeah, because if you're a weirdo, you can find, like, if you have those kind of proclivities, you can find other people online and kind of sympathize, so you don't feel so isolated,
I guess. I think social media has kind of eliminated the social isolation that used to happen
right.
in the pre-internet era. And we were, like, from an age of darkness, before there was an internet.
I know. Yeah. I remember when there was no internet.
Just like Dave Chappelle said, you didn't know who was calling you until you answered the phone.
I know, right? You always had to answer. It might have been important. So this poor woman, Emma Eckstein, they thought that her problem stemmed something to do with her sexual masturbation. It had something to do with her nose, right?
Oh, yeah.
So Freud recommended that she undergo this kind of surgery that this Fleiss person was doing, where they would basically cauterize the inside of your nose.
Like you do. You take away your smell.
Yeah, like, I guess to make you stop jerking it, I don't know.
I would take away most of your sense of taste, too.
Well, food that's what
sucks. But food tasted like shit back then anyway.
Yeah, so it was probably, you know.
Right.
It probably you wouldn't miss much. But
half that shit was rotten.
Yeah, it might have been better, you know.
Yeah.
So basically they cauterized her nose because he had, evidently he had done some of these types of surgeries before, and deemed them successful. Now, I don't think it was successful because their noses were cauterized. I think they were deemed successful because they were given cocaine afterward.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Which, you know, that'll cheer you right up.
Right, yeah.
So I think that's what was causing the success rather than the nasal cauterization. Just a theory.
Yeah, all these guys from this era were all quacks. And I don't know why they're quoted.
Like I said, he probably had, you know, 10%, like, there was some nuggets.
Yeah, but 10% is not good.
But yeah,
that means 90% bullshit.
Yeah. Like, I don't know the exact percentage, but, you know. So evidently the surgery did not go as planned.
I think Jung was closer to the truth, actually.
I agree with him.
Yeah.
So this poor woman...
And he ended up almost being involved in spiritualism and stuff, didn't he, Jung?
Sort of, yeah. Kind of went off in that direction. Remember
spiritualism or what was it? It was some kind of... He started believing supernatural stuff.
Like New Agey kind of stuff?
Yeah, but I don't remember what it was exactly. We'd have to look. We'd have to do a show on
that. I was going
to
say, we should do a show on Carl Jung now that you think about it. That would be a fascinating show. Emma Eckstein, her surgery did not go as planned. Her nose started bleeding all the time and stuff like that. She went back to see about it, and turns out... Just like on pretty much every other episode of Monsters Inside Me, the doctor had actually left about a half meter of gauze up her nose.
Damn.
And so they pulled it all out, and she evidently, like, snorted out, like, all this pus and, like, bone and all this other stuff. And she was permanently disfigured.
Yeah, well, center of her head collapsed in.
Pretty much, yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, her face pretty much caved in.
Damn.
Because of this nose. Ugh. All because they thought that she was masturbating too much, and for some reason that had something to do with
it. Oh, yeah, it'll drive you crazy.
Yeah. So I don't know how those things became associated.
I don't know. Victorians, man. Victorian people were nuts. Well, you know.
I guess they were.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was that sad story. And obviously the nasal sex theory discredited, obviously. Yeah. Although I'm sure there's probably some nose fetishists out there somewhere because, you know. It's the internet, and it's rule 34. Pretty much everything everything has porn of it. I'm sure there's nose porn. So,
crazy.
Yeah, I know.
What's next?
Okay, so the last case I want to talk about, and I actually read a book about this kid. He was a kid at the time. And this was this is kind of a pretty sad case. Back in the 60s, there was a doctor named John Money. And... I don't want to shit on the guy too much because he's actually a very well-respected psychologist. He did a great deal of work in helping patients, like intersex patients, what they would have called hermaphrodites back in the day, who were born with ambiguous genitalia or, you know, had both sets of genitalia or neither set of genitalia or were, you know, had chromosomal abnormalities that cause them to be their gender to be ambiguous.
Yeah, that's a thing too. That's a thing, and that's more common than people thought.
It is very common, and I was surprised at how common it was. It is very common for babies to be born with ambiguous genitals where they can't tell one or the other.
I look back to my high school days, and some people come to mind. They go, "Ah, but they were like that."
Yeah, and also, like I said, chromosomal disorders like XXY and things like that are also very common. He actually was quite well known for, you know, for working with these types of patients and, you know, kind of helping normalize or take away the stigma attached to them and helping them out with various surgeries and stuff like that. Now, unfortunately, one case that really kind of tarnished his reputation and it's really kind of probably the thing that he's best known for nowadays. I mean, he died in the 80s, but, that he's best known for nowadays was this really, and this is very, very, very questionably, the ethics of this were very, very questionable. In 1965, there were a pair of twin boys born, Bruce and Brian Reamer. Now, when the boys were 7 or 8 months old, they were having problems urinating. Yeah, so, and they were diagnosed with phimosis, you know, which is where your foreskin doesn't retract all the way back and whatnot. So doctors recommended...
I was going to say something funny there, but...
What were you going to say?
No. It slipped away.
Oh, okay. I was going to say... It's funny if you don't have it, I'm sure.
Okay, keep going.
But they, I mean, these were babies still.
Right.
So their doctor recommended that they be circumcised. So they were not circumcised for religious reasons. They were not... I mean, nowadays it seems like a lot of babies are circumcised just because, which I don't know why they do that, but...
Make it look pretty.
I guess. Make it look pretty. But so these babies were circumcised later because of a medical issue. Unfortunately, Bruce was the first one to be circumcised. Now, for some reason, I don't know why, but they decided, much like Emma Eckstein's nose, that they were going to cauterize the foreskin off rather than cutting it like they normally would. Mm-hmm. It did not go well. Mm-hmm. And essentially, they burned the poor little kid's penis off.
Yep.
Damn.
More or less. So, jeez. You know, yeah.
How could horrible. You make a mistake like that?
That's what I mean. I mean, I know babies Damn. Are small and baby penises are small, Damn. But still, come on, man. Like, if you're going to do Jeez. That.
Do it right.
Yeah. So,
was there a lawsuit?
Well, yeah. Well, here's the thing. Yeah. I don't even know if there was. But understandably, the other brother, the other twin brother, they were like, yeah, let's not do that to that other kid.
Right.
So, the baby boy's parents were understandably concerned because they said, well, you know, what's he going to do now? I mean, they couldn't do like phalloplasty and stuff back then. I don't think they, or, you know, the surgery was probably in its infancy. So it's like, they're like, well, he's not going to be able to have children. He's not going to be able to have like normal sexual relationships.
They turned that boy into a girl.
Yeah. So they didn't know what to do. So they took him to Dr. John Money because, like I said, Dr. Money was, you know, famous for working with intersex patients. And they said, you know, they burned off his penis. It's like, what should we do? Now, at the time, Dr. Money was one of the leading proponents of the theory that gender or sex or gender was largely due to nurture. It was largely socially constructed. Now, while, I don't know, see, while it's understandable why, because some things about gender presentation and things like that are socially constructed. I mean, obviously.
The window dressing is.
The window dressing, like back
yeah,
in the.
But
like
not
back,
the biology.
Right. But back, you know, back in the old yeah. days, pink and blue. Now, yeah. now it's girl and boy color. But, you know, back in the old days, it was opposite. Yeah. You know, back in the old days, dudes wore makeup and high heels and wigs and no one thought that was girly or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was all manly in the 1700s.
Yeah, that was manly back then.
You were
then.
Pimping.
Yeah.
You were pimping.
So
you
things know. Like that, sure, yeah. socially constructed. However, the problem here was one of, I mean, this boy was not born with ambiguous genitalia. He was not born with any chromosomal aberration.
He was biologically
he
male.
He was biologically male. He was born, right. You know, a heterosexual, yeah. evidently a heterosexual normal with normal male genitalia. But Dr. John Money became convinced, he's like, well, if... Now, he thought if you got them in the window before they turned 2 years old and raised them as a particular gender, then they would identify with that gender. So he suggested to this boy's parents that we will change his name to Brenda and we will raise him as a girl. And also, Dr. John Money, I think it must be said, was kind of like all excited because the kid had a twin brother who was still intact because they hadn't operated on him. So he said twin brother was a perfect control. They wanted to see how things would turn out. So like I said, they changed the kid's name to Brenda, started putting him in dresses, started raising him as a girl and stuff like that.
Reminds me of Glenn or Glenda.
Kind of, yeah. Glenn, but that's a different thing. He was just a transvestite. He just liked to wear women's clothing. Okay. He was straight. So
Didn't work out.
Yeah. Well, as much as John Money liked to say, and there's a lot of he said, she said going on here, right? There's a really good book by, what's his name? John Colapinto, I think is the guy's name. He wrote a book called As Nature Made Him. And I read it a few years ago and it's really good. And that was kind of written from, the kid's perspective. Now, Dr. John Money, he kind of thought at first the experiment was a success. Like all of his paperwork at the time and stuff was like, you know, yeah, he's acting like a girl and he's accepting, you know, he's accepting his gender identity and stuff like that. However, they're not sure if he thought that because, you know, he wanted the experiment to succeed and he was just seeing what he wanted to see, or if the kid's parents were lying to him about how successful it was going. Because, I mean, he didn't see the kid every day. He only saw him like every now and then. What ended up happening was when he started to get a little bit older. Now, keep in mind that he did not know that he'd been born as a boy.
Right.
He said, you know, through his entire youth, probably when he started being like 8 or 9 years old, he started being really uncomfortable with being a girl. He didn't want to do girl things. He didn't, you know, he was given dolls. He didn't want them. He was made to wear frilly dresses. He wouldn't wear them. And he began to get bullied at school and, you know, he was real withdrawn and stuff like that just because, and he didn't really understand why, because like I said, he he wasn't told that he was born as a boy. He was just like, why do I have to wear this? And I don't want to play with that. I want to go climb trees and shoot stuff and everything.
Make a long story short, gender is biological. It's not a social
construct. Biological, yeah. So,
it's not a social construct. They want to say that in some social studies courses in universities today, but humans are animals. Animals are controlled by biology.
In many aspects, they are. And I'm not saying, and like I said, you know, I want to say it's a lot more nuanced than that because, you know, biology and, nature and nurture kind of interact with each other because the human brain is kind of plastic and the environment affects it and your brain and, you know, changes the environment in turn. So it's kind of like a feedback loop type of thing. But in general, if the kid was born a boy and he knew he was he knew it wasn't right.
Right.
That he was being treated. But he didn't know why. So he had like all kind of identity crises. Now,
there are only two genders. There are male and female. And then there's a third section that is kind of a mixture of two different things. Like I said, it's ambiguous. But in general, if you're born male or you're born female, your biology dictates your behavior.
Well, I mean,
humans are not some kind of special spiritual.
I mean, thing. I'm not saying there's
we're animals, we're machines like the other animals.
But I mean, there's a large spectrum of behaviors on that. I mean, obviously, some girls are more boyish than other ones, and some boys are more femmy than other ones, and things like that.
But but they're male or female,
right? There's a big spectrum. So, like I said, they finally told the kid.
They are what they are, though.
Yeah. And like I said, this kid knew something was meant, but he didn't know why. So finally, they told the kid when he was about 12, or right before he went through puberty, that he had been born a boy. And he said that it was a great relief
because he said, not all made sense.
Yeah. He's like, oh, well, that's why. You know what I mean? Right. Because I think the reason they told him was because he flipped out when they were going to take him. Because, you know, he hadn't had a penis and he hadn't had a vagina for his entire childhood. He peed through a hole in his abdomen.
Damn.
Because they hadn't, you know, they hadn't really had.
He didn't know something was wrong?
No, like he just thought something went wrong, you know, when he was a kid. It happened when he was a baby, so he didn't remember. So, you know, when he was getting a little older, they suggested that he go have, a partial rudimentary vagina constructed. Yeah. And he did not want to do that.
Right.
Yeah. Like he specifically said, I'm going to kill myself if you take me back there.
Right.
So, you know, that was when they told him he was a boy. Now, when he was 15, he went back to living as a male. Now, there have been some allegations, and I don't know how true this is, that I mean, they said, him and his brother said that when they were still kids, that Dr. Money would kind of put them into kind of sexual situations where Bruce was, Bruce slash Brenda was made to play the role of the bottom.
Yeah.
And then like the brother would kind of thrust at him, like to kind of show him like how it was supposed to go, I guess.
Weird.
Like I said, I don't know if that's true or not.
Right.
There have been allegations that the kids had false memory system or syndrome, right, or were coached or something like that. But the brothers did say that the doctor made them do that types of things to get their sexual roles right, I guess. So he actually took the name David, even though he'd been born with the name Bruce, but he took the name David later on and started living as a male. Now, eventually he did get, I believe he did get like a phalloplasty, like he had a fake penis constructed. And he actually did go on to marry later on, though I don't think he was ever fertile. Like, he could never have children because they took his testicles off.
Of course.
So he could never have children. But he did marry and he adopted his wife's three children.
Okay.
However, it really did not end in a happy way. Now, he had been given estrogen prior to, like I said, right, when he was a kid. But they stopped. They gave him testosterone later and, you know. So he started living as a boy, and he seemed much happier after that, but he never really recovered.
Of course not.
And and honestly, you know, his brother actually died, his twin brother died of a drug overdose.
Right.
And a couple of years after that, his wife asked for a separation.
Right.
And now before he died, he did tell his story to kind of encourage other psychiatrists not to do that to, right, to a kid anymore. And, you know, from that initial story that he gave, there was a book written, like I said, called As Nature Made Him, which is really good if you want to read it. So after his wife left, he basically drove to a parking lot and blew his head, yeah, off with a shotgun. So, and he was, yeah, he was only in his 30s.
Yeah, I saw a big program on it. You know, they said it's not only just hormones and, you know, genitalia. It's in your cells, too. You can just, you know, pull a cell out of a person and see if they're male or they're female. And sometimes a male might have female cells and vice versa. It's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird.
And like I said, you know, I'm willing to. The problem I had with this was that what should have been done, like I said, the kid was not born with any kind of chromosomal aberration.
Right.
He was not born. He was not an intersex child. He was not transgender. He was not any of those things.
Right.
And the fact that they took away his consent, I mean, to do that, I mean, it was bad enough that they burned his penis off.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I know shit happens and it's terrible and stuff like that. But then to compound that error.
Yeah, right. By changing his sex.
But yeah, the kid, I mean, he was a baby. Yeah. He, yeah, couldn't consent. And for the record, I don't really agree with circumcision anyway.
Well, they thought they could change his sex. They didn't think that sex was a big deal.
Yeah,
so I guess, he's so young, we'll just turn him into a girl.
Yeah, I guess they thought.
It doesn't really work that way.
No, it doesn't. But I mean, I guess they didn't know that. And now they do because, right, of,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But, you know, probably, I mean, the best case scenario, they wouldn't have burned the kid's penis off, but,
yeah.
And the sad thing too was that, and I forgot to mention that, you know, they burned the one kid's penis off. Now the twin brother had the same condition. He had phimosis too, yeah, but it went away on its own later on.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't have even had to do anything. So, you know, that would have been the ideal situation.
Yeah.
Now, had that happened anyway, the ideal situation probably would have been to just leave the kid as he was.
Right. Yeah.
And then see what happened later on.
Right.
You know, and if the kid grew up and was obviously a boy, then you could go from there. You could, right, be like, well, we'll make him a penis and, you know, he still wouldn't be able to have children and stuff like that. But, you know, he, right, wouldn't have had identity crisis his whole life. Poor, yeah, kid. But, yeah, you know, but, so yeah, he ended up killing himself. And I'm sorry, that was kind of like the note we had to,
yeah,
end
on. Yeah, another bummer case.
Because that was kind of a bummer. So it's like, right, God, man, everything. We should have ended with the Freud one because at least that one was kind of funny. Well, except for that.
The show flew by.
That woman. Yeah, it really did. Well, you know, it was kind of an interesting topic. And like I said, oh, I got to write down. We should probably do a show on Carl Jung now that you mention it because, yeah, that would be a good topic to do. But anyway, so all right. So we're done talking, I guess. As always, thank you to Project Entertainment Network for hosting the audio version of our show. And they have a Patreon at patreon.com/projectentnet. If you want to go give them a buck or two, not just done, just support our podcast, also a bunch of other good ones that are on there. And also we have some t-shirts at zazzle.com/13o'clock. There's 5 different designs and you can pick whatever one you want. Yeah. And they're all pretty cool. And I think that's pretty... Oh, and also, I mentioned it at the beginning, but if you're into paranormal stuff, poltergeist stuff specifically, then go and pick up a copy of my newest book, The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena, in print, ebook, or audiobook. And if you like it, please leave me a review on Amazon, because that really does help out.
Yeah.
And I guess that's pretty much it for this week.
Roll music.
Roll music. Bye.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.